Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. Thank you for attending session 324, titled Paradisiacal Glory, Our Future Lives in the Mormon Millennium. We want to ask you to please silence your cell phones. And this session is being recorded, and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Please consider making a donation to Sunstone and subscribing to one of our amazing Sunstone-hosted podcasts. The session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep to the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. And as a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session, you clear the room and speak outside so that other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. A little bit about this session. When Joseph Smith wrote the 10th Article of Faith in 1842, what did our Mormon ancestors imagine the future of faith to look like? Mormonism, born from millennialism, has its own unique take on the great and dreadful day, but is less to say about the particulars of the 1,000-year personal reign of Jesus Christ. What would life look like for the average person born 600 years into the millennium? How would the LDS Church perfectly govern the inhabitants of the renewed earthly paradise as a promised theocracy? What would you want to live there? Paul Haymore is a lifelong member of the LDS Church, born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia. He followed the patented Mormon male path of an Eagle Scout mission, temple marriage, church school degree, multiple children, MBA, and priesthood callings before learning that polyandry in the Book of Abraham translation are a great way to deconstruct a dearly cherished faith. He is currently working on Before a Glass Sea, a religious utopian novel that follows the lives of various individuals living near the end of the Mormon millennium. We will now turn this session over to Paul.
Thank you, Nancy. Can you guys hear me okay? It's a little jerky, yes. All right, well, thanks so much for being here. I'm excited to sort of present some of the ideas that I've been spending a lot of time researching over the last months. Before I begin, I do want to just make it one note. So I'm going to be exploring some themes here that I'm using in a novel that I'm writing. It's called Before a Glass Sea. You can go to beforeaglasssea.com to sign up to get some updates about when the novel will be ready. Okay, so let's jump into it. Just want to start with a warning. The activity we're about to engage in has been explicitly forbidden. I took the screen grab from the Gospel Principles Manual, Chapter 45, on the Millennium. And as you can see, the authors, the church, wants us to avoid the speculation we're about to engage in. So you've been warned. All right. So the central premise of the presentation is basically the question I want to ask myself is, would you want to live in the Millennium? Right, so as an individual, is the stated purpose of our lives, as far as the church is concerned, is we're all sort of striving for personal exaltation, right? That's why we're here. That's what we're doing, and that's where we want to go. And that includes a lot of things like saving ordinances, living a good life, trying to become more like Christ, and then enduring the end, right? So for the church, they have a stated purpose as well, which is they're trying to realize themselves as the kingdom of God. So everything that they're doing right now is sort of in preparation for becoming the kingdom of God, both here on the earth and then obviously in the eternities, right? So that is what they're trying to do. So everything they come out with is sort of at least moving towards that direction. So the question is, you know, would you want to live in a time where everything was sort of governed and ruled by the church? So while we get started, I want to just play just a quick little game. And I'm going to show some pictures, and I want you guys to tell me if you think that this will, you know, be in or out in the millennium. So the first picture I have here is of a snow skier. By a show of hands, how many people think that we'll have snow skiing in the millennium? Okay. So as far as I can tell. So one of the things that's sort of been prophesied is that the valleys and the mountains will be sort of flattened. So the valleys will be exalted and the mountains will be flattened. And so we'll have sort of a mostly flat, topographically, earth. Right? I expect it'll still be round, but the topography of the earth will be flattened. Gentle rolling hills and those sorts of things. So as far as I can tell, unless you're on the bunny slope, there's not going to be any snow skiing. Okay, what about hunting or the use of firearms? Anybody? What do you think? No? True. No weapons in the millennium. So Isaiah talks about this a little bit, that weapons will be sort of turned into plowshares, and there will be no more sort of hunting or killing in the millennium.
He's talking about the millennium?
Yes. All right, this one's a little controversial. This is a red blood cell. So will there be blood in the millennium? We got two yeses. All right. I put a question mark here. I was leaning towards no. The source for this is Bruce R. McConkie in Mormon Doctrine and the Millennial Messiah. So take what you will. If McConkie's considered an authority on this topic, he certainly wrote a lot about it, but it's not supported necessarily in the scriptures that I could find. So that is up for debate. What about eating meat? Is eating meat in the millennium? What do you guys think? Okay. According to the scriptures, no. So all animals will become herbivores. That includes animals and humans. They call it losing their enmity. They'll lie down together and just eat vegetables, I guess. Mostly salads.
Grass.
Grass, yeah. Sounds yummy. Last one here is voting. You think there will be voting in the millennium? I guess you could also sort of extrapolate this to mean civil liberties, or at least the ones that we know. So in this case, no, as far as I can tell, at least in the church, in the kingdom of God, there won't be any voting come the millennium. Christ will reign personally. He'll sort of direct everything. So it's sort of a take it or leave it situation. Okay, thanks for playing my game. So here's what we'll get into. I have basically three sections, and feel free to, you know, if you want to ask a question, if you want to make a comment, I'm happy to receive those either at the end or in the middle of the session. I don't mind. We can sort of talk. Really, you'll find that I'm mostly interested in what others have to say about this. I have some opinions, but I'll try to present them as objectively as I can. So the three main sections will be what is known. So what has been explicitly revealed either through scriptures or through modern prophets. And then what is the purpose? Like, why are we doing this? And finally, what is sort of universal about the human experience that has to be accounted for people living at this time? So I have some ideas and some things I want to sort of throw out there and see what you guys think. Before we begin, any questions? Anything anybody wants? No? Okay. So we'll start with what has been revealed. So I broke these down into sections. First one is, well, the earth will be renewed to a paradisiacal state. This comes after the second coming. As a result of the second coming, there will be destruction across the earth. The wicked will be burned and destroyed, and the only folks left will be sort of terrestrial or above type individuals. And part of the millennium is the restructuring of the earth itself. So it will return to a pre-fall state where it was a paradise. And the topography of the earth will change drastically. The continents will return to a single landmass, which, as it turns out, is actually sort of science. Most scientists believe in a theory called continental drift, and that the continents themselves are, in fact, slowly moving back towards one another. And it seems to be a cycle. They move together and then pull apart over many, many millions of years. The earth will rest from wickedness. So Moses talks about this a little bit. You'll see this in the Old Testament as well, that the earth itself sort of has some lines of dialogue, which is an interesting concept. So the last bullet point, all corruptible things will be consumed. So this basically says anything that is sort of materialistic or corruptible will be consumed. I take it sort of literally, but I don't know what will happen if we consume everything organic or materialistic, because I think that's just about everything. So I'm not quite sure what to do with that at that point. As far as some of the ideas here, so what needs to be considered? Basically, current environmental degradation will be reversed. So anything that we're doing right now to, you know, hurt the earth, whether it's through pollution or carbon emissions or global warming, basically is going to get a full reset. So does that imply that we really don't need to worry too much about how we treat the planet, considering that we're just going to start all over at the millennium, right? God will just come and make everything better. And what are the implications of that? Do we need to really worry too much about what we do from an organic perspective? The premillennial environmental catastrophes that we face, so any sort of impacts to the Earth as a result of earthquakes or fires or tornadoes, those are sort of impermanent, right? Again, it goes back to that reset. In the millennium, we'll have to account for agriculture and food production, so I assume access to water will be sort of plentiful. I talked to a geologist trained from Stanford about sort of what are the ramifications of a flattened topography. Basically, his take was that would require sort of either massive wet zones or massive dry zones, as the water has sort of nowhere to stay. Generally, they stay up at the top of the mountains, and then they sort of trickle down, which has all sorts of important factors for our everyday ecology. You know, obviously, there are lots of organisms and that rely on the setup, right? There's mountain goats, for instance, rely on mountains to survive. And so without those, you know, what happens to those species? Do they go away? Do they have to adapt? Are they changed like humans are? And so with those massive wet and dry zones, I assume God will just sort of handle the ramifications of a flat sort of topographical Earth. Okay, so the other thing I think is interesting here is the lines of dialogue that the Earth has in the scriptures. Does that sort of imply that the Earth is a sentient being, right? And that they have it has its own purpose, some creation aspect of its creation that we have to account for, and is mistreatment of that sort of constitutes sin, right? Obviously, it's a sin to mistreat one another, and so you know, I wonder what the ramifications of that are. The other interesting thing about the millennium, if we're living in this sort of paradisiacal state, is, you know, what are the ramifications of pollution? Right now, we know a lot of our manufacturing, a lot of our transportation, a lot of our mass agriculture creates massive amounts of pollution for the Earth. And so with the reset into this paradise, are we able to pollute, you know, for 1,000 years? I don't know. The scriptures really don't talk about that at all, but I think that would be something we would have to take into consideration, right? Okay, any thoughts, questions from the audience on this particular one before I move on? Yeah.
Thank you. The hills and the valleys will be laid low. The valleys will be raised up. I have read very often, I'm studying chaos theory in the Book of Mormon, often as a chaotic, spontaneous self-reorganization of everything, a whole new order that will eventually then emerge on Earth. So I would be reluctant to go to a flattened Earth as the end game, but as an intermediate process in what is going to then reorganize a planet. And so I look at it more metaphorically.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that that's a common interpretation, right? You can sort of look at this and take a literalist view, right? Or you can take a metaphorical view. As it relates to the church, you know, the early church, when they were sort of set up, most of the saints believed that the millennium was right around the corner, right? So Joseph Smith was very clear that the millennium was, you know, nigh. And they expected it to happen in their lifetimes. There's some quotations by Smith that say that, you know, if he lives to 80, that the Christ would come again, and the start of the millennium would come at the end. He didn't make it that far, but you know, that would have been about 1890-ish.
He set the date.
Yeah, he sort of set. That's right. So after his death, and the saints moved to the West, a lot of church members even thought, well, Joseph Smith would have lived to 80. This is sort of the date that this will happen, and so they sort of expected that. After that didn't happen, they sort of got away from some of the millenarian conversation. It was very popular up until John Taylor and Wilford Woodruff, and then there's not as much written. This came back up again during sort of the early, like, mid-1900s. So Joseph Fielding Smith, the Bruce R. McConkies, up to Boyd Packer, had a lot more to say about millenarianism, which is why you see some of the documentation or emphasis on, for instance, food storage, right? Preparing for the second coming, sort of being ready. I remember that being sort of a big bit of rhetoric when I was a kid, right? But you don't see so much of that anymore, the emphasis on 2-year supplies, at least not these days. But to your question, right, I think the early saints did sort of take a literalist view of it. I know as we read McConkie and as we read Fielding Smith, that they take a very literalist view of what the scriptures say. There's some, these could be metaphor as well. I don't know. And obviously it's within God's power to do whatever he wants, right? If he wants to make the mountains appear again, he can. After the millennium is over, Satan will be released again. There will be sort of a final battle. And at that point, the earth will become celestialized. Joseph Smith predicted that the earth would be like a glass sea, sort of the name for the book that I'm writing. So it would be like a glass sea, a Urim and Thummim that someone could look into. And so that sort of implies to me that, you know, that it's a sort of flat surface. But who knows? Could be. Any other thoughts? Okay. So the next date is there will be birth but no death. I put death in quotations here because from a technical aspect people die, but the state of death is sort of much different from what we sort of know now. So humans will live to be 100 years old, and then they'll be sort of twinkled into immortality, which I'm not entirely sure what the mechanics of that look like. I don't know if this is where the blood goes away, but essentially what will happen is they won't, be buried. They'll just become immortal at that point, and they'll be able to sort of stick around and continue on with their work. Carnivores no longer eat meat, but instead will be converted to herbivores. So, this is in Isaiah. Humans no longer have blood flowing. Again, this is sort of a Bruce R. McConkie construct, but because it's quoted in a number of official church publications, notably student manuals from various scriptures, I decided to include it. Disease is eradicated, again, from McConkie, and then without death, there is no sorrow. So, DNC 101 sort of says, because there's no death, there won't be any sorrow during the millennium. So, the death thing is sort of tricky too, because Joseph Smith alluded to a purge of folks during the millennium. So, during this time, there will be non-sort of members of the church that live. They live in their own sort of nation states that are subservient to the Mormon church. And I keep saying church, but at this point, they are sort of everything, right? They are the government. They are the the power on the earth. But in any event, they'll be proselyted too, and if they don't convert, Smith talks about them being removed at some point during that 1,000-year reign. So, any questions about this one? Yeah.
I was just wondering real quick, when you say they would be removed at that point, do you have any concept of what that removal would be like?
That's a good question. So I've sort of blocked it out here in my notes, but essentially what Smith says is, I'll quote him, the heathen nations who will not come up to worship will be visited with the judgments of God and must eventually be destroyed from the earth. So whatever Joseph Smith thinks God's destruction is how I sort of presume that will happen. The word destroyed is ominous, he's God, so maybe the destruction is merely saying, okay, well, you guys are done, and then transporting you away, right?
Without death, there is no sorrow, but there's all kinds of sorrow that is not related to death.
Yeah.
And if there's no sorrow, is there no joy?
So as you and I both know, there's a lot of, dualism in our lives. The church actually teaches us in the scriptures that, there must be opposition in all things, right? And so to know true joy, you have to know sorrow. If we look at DNC 101, it's pretty straightforward. It, like I said, implies that death is the idea of death is the source of sorrow, which in my lived experience, as you rightly allude to, is not what I sort of know. I mean, I've never died. I've had people die around me, but I've been sorry or felt sorrow for lots of other reasons. And so in my opinion, I think it's a bit simplistic to just point to death as a construction for sorrow. This is their utopia, so maybe, right? I don't know. OK. Good question, though. Thank you. I think the other thing I sort of want to point out here is that, you know, without death, right, I'm assuming we're not going to have an overpopulation problem. Once you're immortal, I guess you can sort of go wherever you want, and so the earth will, I presume, handle as many people as the Lord decides to put on it. But I did think it interesting that we have this birth rate, but we don't have a death rate, which, you know, if we were outside of maybe these constructs, that would be an alarming problem we'd have to account for. So I don't know what their plan is for that. I just threw out an idea. There's probably lots of other ways that we could look at it. The other thing I was interested in here is that, not only is there no death, but disease being eradicated, right? So I guess no one is going to get sick, as far as I can tell, right? And if there's no death for these believers or citizens of the church, then I assume accidents aren't a thing. Like, you can't fall off a building and die or something. Get run over by a plowshare. I'm not sure what a plowshare looks like. But. Okay, so the other question I have is, I guess animals and human populations can't really disrupt the ecosystem, whatever that ecosystem ends up looking like, in order to maintain its paradise state. I assume the paradise is a constant, right? That once he sets the earth up as this, you know, pre-Adamic or Garden of Eden paradise, that it will stay that way until the millennium ends. At the very least. And then I wonder if animals are subject to the twinkling. So we know they won't die, but do they sort of get twinkled into immortality at 100 years? Or maybe mosquitoes who only live but a few days get twinkled at that point. So I don't know. All interesting things. Any questions before I move on to the next one? Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, now it says they're going to live to be the age of a tree.
Right.
In that reference you give. Okay, so where's the 100 years come?
Yeah, so the 100 years comes from Brigham Young. Okay. So he sort of expounded on this verse and talked about 100 years being the set. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Although that's a good point. I mean, some trees, I think, live longer than others, so... I guess in order to have an answer, we had to set a time frame. Okay, so the next one, the next major feature of the Mormon utopia of the millennium is Satan will be bound and cannot tempt man. So they also talk about the fact that children born during this time period, at least in the kingdom of God, will be raised in the gospel and will grow up without sin. So they won't have a construction for sin. They won't be able to make. They say actually grow up to salvation, without sin. So, you know, I wonder what that would be like to have children that don't do anything wrong. But, you know, that sounds good. Personal agency remains, and humanity is free to choose. One thing that, over and over again, there's not a lot of concrete ideas. There's just sort of these implications. So there's some explicit statements, but most of these are sort of implied. One thing that is sort of constant is the prophets and the scriptures are clear that agency is not something that God can infringe upon. And so, you know, you sort of remain able to act on your own. But if there is no Satan to tempt you to do something wrong, can you sin, right? Can you make a decision that's contrary to God? And if so, what is the motivating factor for that? Why would anybody do that if there's no sort of push towards that? Does that imply that there's sort of this innate drive that's outside of Satan and outside of God that you can just sin? Or you know, what's that about? I don't know. Do you have a question?
On the first one, it says that the children are raised in the gospel grow up without sin, but then the second one, since we have personal agency, will remain and humanity is free to choose sin. So that's kind of contrary to what they're saying.
Yeah, so, I mean, I suppose the option to sin is there, but apparently no one will,
huh.
Right? So, again, I don't have a, I can't, it's hard for me to ground that in my personal experience, but it does seem a little paradoxical, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and it also drives a question I have is for, you know, what honest responsibility do we have as it relates to sinning if Satan isn't the one that is sort of to blame for those things? So if I'm just created this way, you know, do I really bear responsibility? I'm not my own creator, I don't think. At least I'd have some conversations with myself if I were. Maybe make some changes. To another idea that I thought here is, you know, what is a compelling reason to choose something other than what the church has sort of put forth, right? If I'm living in a utopia without sorrow and without death, why, what choice is that? Like, who would do that rationally, right? Russ, do you want to?
You will still have curiosity. And curiosity and comedy often has consequences, not premeditated. Just look at the story of Garden. Everything was perfect.
Yeah.
But somebody came along, introduced curious option.
Yeah, so it's Yeah, so, you know, so what Russ is saying here is that curiosity can be sort of a catalyst for a choice. In the example that you gave, there's a, you know, the very real presence of Satan sort of instigating that curiosity.
I'm just curious. I can get too curious. It's a pretty big moment.
Yeah. I actually have some comments on curiosity later. We'll get to those. That'll be interesting. We'll bring it back. Okay, so does this also imply that there's no contention, right? We know contention is of the devil, so how will disagreements be adjudicated? Is that something we do? Maybe. And then, okay. I'm going to move on. Next one. Any other questions? All right. So 1,000 years of peace for humanity. This is also another big theme that comes along in the literature and in the documentation. So one of the things I found interesting was that humanity will no longer remember the earth as it was. So these are, you know, people who are, I guess, around when the millennium starts won't remember a pre-millennial life. I'm not sure to what degree this makes too much sense to me. If I were God, I don't know that I would want my people to stop remembering all the good things that I did for them or all the lessons that I was expecting them to learn prior to the start of the millennium. So my assumption here is that maybe they don't remember the state of affairs, like the ideas that were presented or created by men during this point. Like, will they remember that football was a thing? I mean, maybe that's not that important in the millennium. So it could refer to, I suppose, sort of non-relevant items that, you know, exist during that time. The languages will be changed, so we'll only have one language for all inhabitants living during the millennium. That's a pure language. That's the, what they call it, but they don't specify what particular tongue that is. I referenced this earlier, but, you know, man and beast will no longer feel enmity towards one another. So this is where you have some of the language around, you know, beasts lying down with one another and sort of hanging out and, you know, being cool, you know, not fighting. Weapons of war destroyed, and humanity is no longer taught or learns how to make war. So, it's, again, this whole idea of, like, military theory goes away. There's no reason to learn how to, you know, to contend with one another. So, a common misconception is that all people living during the millennium will be members of God's government and God's church. This actually isn't true. Otherwise, why do missionary work? So, there will be other nations who are around during the millennium. And this is a bit of a paradox, too, because they have to yield authority and deference to Christ's government. So he reigns personally. He rules everything. He sets the standards. And so the expectation is that they must yield that authority and obedience to his government. And so are they really sort of an autonomous agent unto themselves? Can they really? It doesn't really sound like they can make any decisions, right? So why would they make, for instance, laws or govern in a way contrary to what they have to do? So I'm not quite sure what that means exactly, but, you know, in order to, like I said, in order to do missionary work, you have somebody to preach to, right? And then going back, Russ, to your point, all things being revealed by the end of the millennium. So God will reveal everything. Every question that we've had, every doctrine, theology, thought experiment will become available to us. So what are the implications of a full breadth of knowledge on everything? Do concepts like curiosity, the drive towards innovation, entrepreneurship, are these things irrelevant at this point because there's really nothing new to discover? So, I don't know. Maybe curiosity goes away.
How could there possibly not be new things to discover?
I'm sorry, say that again?
If it's eternal progression,
yeah.
How could there possibly not be new things to discover?
Perhaps personal discovery exists, but the way I read this is that, you know, there's a record. If you have a question, there's a record where you could go find the answer.
Also read that as what happened during the Renaissance when they rediscovered all Greek manuscripts and suddenly discovered this guy named Aristotle.
Right.
It got pretty exciting.
Yeah, so, you know, maybe that's another thing that happens during that time period is we sort of educate ourselves with all of the best material. So. Right.
What's the God will give anything to miss that?
Oh, yeah.
What kind is the mic?
Yeah, do you guys mind standing up to the mic?
They're recording.
I think you can
hear me. No.
We can hear you, but they're recording.
They're recording.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I just missed the one, God will give anything to any man that asks. What does it mean by anything?
So anything is a very complete word. And as it turns out, D&C 101:27 is sort of that in a nutshell, right? Like, it's as simple as that. And so I think this goes back to the idea that, you know, ask of God and he'll grant it unto you. You know, knock and he shall receive. Or ask and he shall receive. So, yeah, I guess the idea of not having enough for yourself is a thing of the past. So you can just ask for it and God will grant it to you. And by anything, I presume that he means precisely what he says, which is anything. So if you want a milkshake, I guess you get a milkshake.
Good iceberg, though.
I think you can get that. But I don't know. I mean, you know, you ask him. Go ahead.
Yeah, actually very interesting because in the ancient world, modern science did not exist. There were people who were working on mathematics and technical issues, but it was all craft. In the Middle Ages, what was old was admired. I don't remember exactly who it is, but the author of one of the famous medieval novels starts it with, I'm going to tell you again the story you've heard so many, many times before, but I'm going to tell it again, because he has to convince his readers that this is an old story. So it really is the age of science that brings about this idea of new and innovative things, and Mormonism reflects that very much with the doctrine of eternal progression. Mm. That's a little bit at odds, though, with some of this millennial thinking, where you have this idea that there's going to be an end to all of this. Then, don't you think there's a?
Yeah, it does sort of feel that way. What I've tried to do when thinking of that is to say, look, the millennium is a set. Sure.
Yeah. Hand it when people talk, because otherwise the recording is going to have all that noise in it. So
yeah, so, you know, the millennium is a certain time frame, right? It's only 1,000 years. So perhaps some of the things that are done during the millennium are taken away. I sort of don't think that's probably the way it goes, but I guess that's a possibility. But yeah, the idea of all things being revealed has these weird implications as it relates to, you know, progress, right? Progress implies that there's something unknown that we must sort of search for. So, the last one I want to talk about as it relates to what is known is Christ will establish his perfect government and will rule personally. So all existing nations will be disbanded. So the United States will go away. It won't be a thing anymore. And the church will become the world government. Political and spiritual matters are directed through Christ and executed by the priesthood. So he will set, again, all the standards and say, here are the policies. Now you, priesthood, go and execute those policies. Political matters are managed from Missouri through Zion, right, the New Jerusalem. spiritual matters will come through Jerusalem. So there'll be two sort of world capitals. And then mortals and immortals will participate in that administration of affairs here on the earth. So I'm assuming because this is a perfect government, the rights of the individual cannot be infringed upon. And so there's really no need for any sort of redress of grievances. There aren't any grievances to be had. I assume they will handle all sort of social or bureaucratic or policy decisions perfectly. So if there's a need for sanitation in the millennium, they will have the perfect plan for how to handle a population of sanitation needs. I assume there's no need for political dissent, right? It's a perfect utopia, so there's no point to having a different idea because everything is done perfectly. So that'll be weird. And then I don't think people will be able to really conceive of anything that's subversive or profane, right? They won't be able to sort of subvert the government. Or if they do, they'll be sort of kicked out. So as far as like personal civil liberties, I think they will all be sort of perfectly handled, right, by the government. One note I had here is that the economy of God, right, there must be some sort of economy here. They don't state this explicitly, but I assume whatever that economy looks like will be perfect. We have the law of consecration, which perhaps is to be administered as the United Order, something that, they failed at in the past. Perhaps that will be the way that economy is managed in the future. All right, so what's the purpose? What are we going to be doing during this time frame? So there's two main things. You could probably already guess them. There's missionary work, which incorporates proselyting. So I don't really know that much needs to be said about that, but there'll be some cadre of people going out to the various heathen nations that still exist during the millennium and, preaching the word of God. And eventually the first principles of the gospel will be known by all non-members. So much like, much like we take for granted from a primary perspective, that will just be common knowledge to everybody regardless of their state of belief or disbelief. So the message will fill the entire earth. And then the next big one, which has a little bit more about it in the literature, is temple work. So a lot of temple building on our single landmass. Apparently we'll have temples dotting the earth, and so somebody's got to build those temples. There'll be genealogy that happens. Obviously we'll be researching the past and trying to connect ourselves to it. We'll be doing proxy temple ordinances, and then mistakes will be corrected. The mistakes that were made prior to the millennium in research of genealogy will be corrected here during the millennium, and so apparently those mistakes will be corrected by way of immortal beings who will point out where the errors are. This leads me to sort of a question of, this sort of sounds like a lot of busy work, right? This is the gospel of bureaucracy and red tape. Like, we have to sort of find all the names and put them in a catalog and have a database, and then we have to actually tactilely perform the ordinances on someone, either themselves or by proxy. I don't know why God can't just use his infinite power to know what to do and who needs to do what and who would accept this or that. So my only assumption for this is that this work is mostly for us and not for him, right? So it's important for us to perform this work, maybe. I don't know. Any thoughts there? Any questions? Okay. So.
About the whole presentation?
No, we'll get to the. I'm almost done. We'll get there.
I'm not trying to rush you.
Yeah. Well, I need to rush. I'm running out of time. All right, other millennial activities. So people will be engaged in building their own homes, planting and harvesting their own crops. So I guess one of our professions during the millennium will be farmers. So if you like that, good for you. If you don't, tough cookies, I guess. We will eat, drink, and wear clothing. So Brigham Young talked about this a little bit in this Journal of Discourses. This also comes from Isaiah. So it's good to know that we won't be naked, I guess. And then we will also advance and become a perfect society. So whatever the zenith of society is, whatever that looks like, that will be us. It's a little short on details there, but that's the claim. All right? Maybe we'll have clothes makers, too, maybe. All right, so what will humanity experience? So obviously there's things that all of us sort of deal with on a day-to-day basis, just part of being human. We alluded to some of these concepts, right? Where does sorrow come from? It's not just death. These are emotions, things we feel sort of as a species. And so I've tried to think through what are some of those things that are ubiquitous that we need to maybe account for. So one of the first things I thought of is, you know, that duality. So, you know, we obviously have our own individualism, but we also work in pluralistic societies. There's tribes, right? It's important for us to be aware of our tribes and to understand our relationship, you know, both to them and inside and outside. So from a tribe's perspective, there'll be believers in Christ and non-believers in Christ. I think that will probably be the main thrust of tribalism in this world. Nation states, there will initially be a tribe of nation states. Of course, they'll be destroyed, as we pointed out earlier. I assume there's going to be families. It doesn't actually state this, but considering sort of the broader doctrines of the gospel, I assume family is an important tribe that one can participate with. And then tribes of Israel. So prior to the millennium, the tribes of Israel will be gathered. That'll be part of the millennial activities as well. And they'll know who they are and sort of receive the gospel and accept it and do their own work as part of their tribe. So I don't know if those identities continue or persist through the millennium, but I assume they're there sort of at the beginning. So how does, in this purpose, so the question really here is, in this sort of framework, in this utopia, you know, what do we do about tribes? What boundaries exist, and how are they enforced? Whose responsibility is it to enforce if somebody, you know, sort of breaks the expectation of the tribe? So if I wear the wrong bit of clothing, for instance, who's responsible for sort of correcting me? Or is that not a thing? Is boundary enforcement not a thing in tribes? What effect would widespread conformity have on humanity, right? So we're all trying to conform to whatever the perfect utopia is set up for us. So we're members of that government in this case. So right now we sort of have our own ideas. We sort of, you know, some of us like to not conform. So if you don't, if you're not a conformist, you know, what will that have on your identity? And then will we tolerate any different ideas, right? Are our preferences that are outside of whatever the standards are totally gone, or you know, is that around? All right. So morality and values, are all morals and values set by Christ or the church, right? Are they sort of set top and then driven down? Are you able to sort of conceive your own sense of morality outside of what the church, you know, requires? Is the millennial utopia entirely a patriarchy? So we talked about the fact that all these things are sort of executed by the priesthood, and what I know about the priesthood right now is it's entirely made up of males. So, you know, are they the ones that have power in this situation, and how do we handle matters of equality in that aspect? Again, we've spoken a little bit about personal autonomy, and I just gave some examples here. So would you want your government to dictate how many earrings you can wear, for instance, or whether it's okay to have a tattoo or use birth control? Right now, the church has opinions on those topics, but our government, you know, doesn't particularly. But once, you know, once the church and the government become one, you know, do you want to live in a world where the government can tell you what you can and can't do? I guess they do that already, but to this degree. So how is dissemination of information assured? So if everything is controlled by one central power, you know, how are we to know if what we're being told is the right thing? I assume it's sort of implicit in the statement that everything is done perfectly, so I don't know if there's any need to worry about that in this world. Biology. So right now, evolution leads us towards greater diversity. You know, we're sort of adapting as a group, both us as well as our, you know, things around us. So, you know, what happens from a diversity perspective? If we're not afraid of dying or disease, what happens to our innate fight and flight needs? And as far as, you know, passing along and protecting our DNA, now that survival is ensured, are we as, you know, concerned about that sort of thing, right? Or do we sort of let that go? Okay, cultural influences. What creative expression is allowed in the millennium? I assume creativity is still okay. I just think it's probably not allowed to be anything that doesn't glorify God, I guess. So if it's something that leads one towards away from God, I suppose it won't be allowed. What impact does the homogeneity have for the populace, right? So everybody's sort of striving for the same thing. We hear this in the rhetoric of Zion, right? If you're not one, you're not mine. And so Will everybody have the same preferences, the same ideas, the same values? We have a little bit of this currently, right? The church does have certain areas that they do have total control over. So we see this prominently on campuses of universities that they maintain. So they set dress and grooming standards and then they enforce them. Will that be what's going on as well? Will they have standards about the way you look or what you can wear? And what are the ramifications for breaking those standards? I assume maybe nobody wants to break them, so it won't be a problem. The next bullet point is particularly interesting to me. The current culture of hero worship of church leaders, right? That's something that happens a lot. We sort of speak reverently about these folks. There's no criticism really accepted in the church about the leaders. We have examples of this both in church history as sort of everyday life. So in a world where there is no distractions of celebrities or sports stars or other sort of heroes that we construct as a society, will the worship of church leadership become a bigger problem than it is already? Are people even able to construct of anything that is immoral or unsavory, even as it relates to church history, right? So if everything is known, then I presume we'll know everything that the church has sort of done and taught throughout the ages, and in some cases, the backing away from things, right? So will people know all that, and will they have a problem with perhaps some of the unsavory aspects of the church? Right now, the church continues to frame itself as victims, right? So they sort of we're striving against the immorality of the world, and we're being persecuted for it. So will they continue that framework in a world where they basically dominate everything? I don't know. Restoration of ordinances and doctrines. I presume that we'll restore all these ordinances and doctrines. So does that mean that we'll have, you know, some of these more off-putting doctrines come back, like polygamy and polyandry? What version of the endowment will we use? And the endowment has changed quite a bit over the years, and so which one do we use? So what are the promises of the Mormon millennium? No disease, no death, no sorrow, no scarcity, no uncertainty, no fear, no suffering, and no discord. So Christ controls everything. I assume that means from a, you know, either join us or die perspective, in my definition, that sort of means no freedom. I am free to choose, but no one would do it. And I don't have a construction to choose something else, right? So that doesn't really sound like a real choice. Sort of Hobson's choice. Okay, so with all that said, you know, would you want to live in the millennium under these conditions? So that's the presentation. Last thing I want to mention before we open it up for more questions and ideas. Again, feel free to subscribe to find out updates about the book. And then I also have a friend of mine doing a graphic novel out under the booth. Please be sure to check it out. It's called The Glass Looker. It's really good. He's a great artist with a lot of good research. So be sure to check him out as well. All right. Questions, comments? And just so you guys know, I think we have 10 more minutes.
I'll take less than two.
Great. I'll hold you to it.
I'm astounded at the quality and volume of your reading and the sources you have covered.
Thank you.
I'm appreciative of your putting the lens of what you've chosen to select as important about the millennium on all of the major issues being talked about at Sunstone. That is a very creative, not only activity, but contribution. Thank you.
Thanks. Appreciate that, Russ.
Observation.
Okay.
I'm assuming, but that assumption is based on an extrapolation that is based on a very tenuous fact. And one of the things that is tough about what happens here is often people spend more time on assumptions and justify them by extrapolations, not by data. My experience. So I'm making an assumption that you have read Orson Scott Card's Seventh Son series, that you have seen the Book of Mormon story, that you have seen Angels in America, and that you know a great deal about Kurt Vonnegut. I never get his name right. Vonnegut. I'm assuming that. All of that's very relevant to what you're doing. So the question I have is, when will the book be ready, and what help do you need to get there? Because you're obviously a novelist.
Ah, that's a great question, Russ.
And you're doing the kind of work novelists do.
Yeah.
So when will it be Paul Haymore instead of J.K. Rowling?
So I would love to get an eight-movie deal with Warner Brothers and just live a life of Harry Potter money. But, so my goal is to have the book ready by this time next year. I have a day job. I work in middle management in corporate America. So if I could quit that and do something more interesting, I would love to do that.
And your free agency made that possible, right? Just checking.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So that's my goal, is to do that. And what will it take? Hey, listen, if you've got some extra cash laying around and you want to fund my lifestyle while I quit my job and write, great. But other than that, I'm okay.
I want to fund your lifestyle. I want to fund your output, and I need a return on investment guarantee.
Okay. Well, let's talk afterwards. All right.
So what is your premise for the book, obviously taking place there? Is it going to follow one particular character? Is it going to be, are they going to be happy in the utopia? Or is there going to be strife, because you have to have strife for a plot?
Yeah, that's been a great question. That's been something that has fascinated me about all of this, right? Every narrative that is interesting has conflict, right? It has generally the hero's journey, very Campbellian. Right, the ability to sort of overcome something, either themselves or their environment or some actor against them, right? So in a world where we don't have any death or sorrow or no disease and nobody feels pain and you can just ask for things and get it, right, there doesn't seem to be a lot of room for conflict. So in the themes of the book I'm sort of exploring is, imagine somebody who has no construct of our world and what we deal with and only knows that 600 years in, but then they're sort of presented with something that challenges their dearly held beliefs, right? Sort of what they expect of the world. And we sort of go on that journey with that character, and there's obviously twists along the way. It's sort of sci-fi in that regard. The church doesn't seem to mind technology. They sort of like it. And so you'll see maybe some of these items addressed through the use of technology.
Okay, sorry to take over the mic again. But what I find so interesting is, I was thinking, for instance, of the book The Giver that many of us probably have read. It's YA, where you're in a perfect world, but there exists an alternative.
Right.
And what if there is no alternative, because this is God's plan and this is the end game? Like, I'm interested to see where that goes.
Yeah. Yeah, I really love The Giver. I think that they handle that question of utopia very well in that regard. So, yeah, stay tuned, as they say.
Just one comment first. When you brought up the point of not remembering the world as it previously was, that reminded me of my experience in the Missionary Training Center in Provo, because it was strongly discouraged and enforced that you weren't allowed to talk about anything outside of the gospel and your experience as a missionary. And so I'm wondering if it will be similar, where over a period of time, everything will just kind of fade out as it's no longer talked about or referenced in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And my other thought was about your comment about creativity, and that made me think of how so much creativity is in art and music is inspired by sorrow or pain, and the influence that a paradisiacal world would have on the ability to create meaningful art or music of that nature.
Yeah, I feel the same way, right? Like, I think a lot of great art comes out of those emotions, and in many ways, a lot of that great art is subversive for its time. You know, sometimes we don't look at the art from antiquity as subversive because we've sort of normalized it, but at the time, a lot of that art is subversive. So, you know, that sort of sanitized, perfect creative expression doesn't really excite me. So, yeah, that's a good point. Thank you.
Baumgartner, in his book Longing for the End, about 1990, writes extensively about the millennial impulse, mostly in Christianity, but it's also found in Judaism and Islam.
Yeah.
And he points out, he mentions the Munsterite uprising in Germany, which was referred to by Michael Quinn in one of his talks earlier,
yeah,
which was a disaster. He also, towards the end of his book, talks about the Third Reich as having had millennial components. They were building a thousand-year reign and were feeding into this to some extent. Basically, as he goes through the book, very often these millennial movements end in disaster.
Right.
And you may want to look into that a little bit, you know, as you do your research and look into the book, that not everything may be pretty and nice.
Yeah, it's a great point. I should point out that Mormons didn't conceive of, of millennialism, you know, on their own. This millennialism has a long history, you know, in many different constructs. You talked about a few that are even non-religious, right? So generally, millennialism is... And the research, you know, sort of shows that millennialist thinking becomes popular for disenfranchised groups or persecuted groups. And so, you know, they're looking for something to sort of alleviate their persecution or their disenfranchisement or whatever they're struggling with. And they're not powerful enough to do it themselves. And so they sort of point towards this all-knowing, all-perfect thing that will sort of come and save them from, you know, their suffering. And you know, once their suffering ends, the emphasis on that sort of goes away, right? They don't think about it as much. And so one can point to that and say, you know, there's really nothing supernatural or whatever about millennialism. It's just an idea that people use to help them feel better about their world. One more minute. Okay, any more thoughts? Yeah, do you want to?
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, thank you. Great.
I apologize for being late.
That's okay.
Like I had to go back and get my thing. You know how you get it. So. I think about millennial movements coming out of, you talk about suffering and pain. And I wonder why we don't really talk about Joseph Smith and how their family, you know, think about, you know, allegories in the Book of Mormon, but just living on the freaking edge of the wilderness,
right,
trying to survive. I mean, we just can't conceptualize the suffering that it was. You know, has anyone over here dug up a tree stump? We just don't have any idea how just excruciatingly hard it was.
Yeah.
And to have, you know, death just haunting you and knocking at your door at every wake. I would have been doing every freaking prayer magic circle, too.
Yeah, anything.
I would have been doing all of that stuff.
Yeah.
That's all I wanted to say.
No, it's a good point. I mean, as we know about the Joseph Smith family, as they suffered, right? They spent a lot of time struggling to even survive, right? They lost their farm a number of times. You know, they couldn't provide, you know, most of their life. And so it sort of makes sense that somebody raised in that environment would sort of, as they're looking for alleviation, would talk about, hey, this is what's important to me, and I'm going to push this narrative. So it sort of fits in there. Yeah. Okay. Thanks so much for your time, everybody.